This episode is brought to you by Tegas, the only investment research platform built for fundamental investors. Think about how hard you are working to get the insights you need to make a great investment decision, how many hours you spend digging through public records and expert transcripts, or manually updating those complex models. Investors should compete on their ability to analyze investments, not how well they aggregate data. That's why Tegas offers a unified end-to-end research platform that combines robust qualitative content sets, up-to-date financial data, management and culture checks, and more, all in one easy-to-use, streamlined user experience. 95% of the top 20 global private equity firms use Tegas. Learn more and get your free trial at tegas.com/Patrick.
This is Business Breakdowns. Business Breakdowns is a series of conversations with investors and operators diving deep into a single business. For each business, we explore its history, its business model, its competitive advantages, and what makes it tick. We believe every business has lessons and secrets that investors and operators can learn from, and we are here to bring them to you. To find more episodes of Breakdowns, check out joincolossus.com.
All opinions expressed by hosts and podcast guests are solely their own opinions. Hosts, podcast guests, their employers, or affiliates may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions.
This is Matt Russell, and we are releasing a bonus episode of Breakdowns today. While we typically love to cover businesses, we thought this was an interesting opportunity to cover a special situation around a business, and in this case, the FTX bankruptcy. I was joined by Aaron Broderick, head of U.S. cross-border restructuring and insolvency at Evershed Sutherland, and Aaron represents the ad hoc committee of non-U.S. customers for FTX. So that's given her a front row seat and a hands-on seat to everything that's unfolded at FTX since they entered Chapter 11 in November of 2022. We tried to cover some of the basics around bankruptcy proceedings using FTX as a lens to compare to other restructurings, and Aaron helped explain what the key negotiating points have been in this particular case. We'd love your feedback on this episode, so if you're listening on Spotify, drop us a response there, or you can respond to any of our social media accounts linked in the show notes of this episode. Now on to the conversation with Aaron on FTX. All right, Aaron, thank you very much for joining us here in what is a different flavor of episode for Business Breakdowns. We're typically diving into a specific business that's an ongoing entity and basically picking it apart. Here, we have a business at the center of everything, but we're going to talk about what happened with FTX and specifically with the reorganization, restructuring of FTX. And to kick us off, it would just be helpful to hear your own background and how you are tied into the situation at FTX. So maybe we can start there.
I'm a partner at Evershed Sutherland. I head up the U.S. cross-border and international restructuring department. I've been a restructuring attorney for almost 20 years now. And I became involved in FTX in representing the ad hoc committee of non-U.S. customers, which is currently comprising about 75 members holding over $2.5 billion in claims against FTX.
Not a insufficient number or small number there. Maybe we just start at the beginning. In November 2022, slightly prior to that, things got very intense with FTX. Allegations came out. And what ultimately ended up happening was a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So my understanding with Chapter 11 is that there's a reorganization. You're not intending to liquidate the assets. There's some business behind it, and there's some restructuring effort to keep this business going. And that's different than Chapter 7. But tell me where I am wrong in that assessment of Chapter 7 versus Chapter 11 and what the ultimate process was here in terms of going into bankruptcy.
Sure. Well, Chapter 11 is known as a reorganization proceeding, whereas Chapter 7 is a liquidation. In practice, that's a bit misleading. Really, the key distinction is that in the Chapter 11, you have a debtor in possession process, which means the company's management and board can stay in power and in control. And in a Chapter 7 proceeding, it's turned over to a court-appointed trustee. So I think what's confusing in the FTX case is obviously the company's insiders could not be trusted to remain in control. So there was a shift over to John Wray as the company's new CEO and new appointments made for the board. But it is a debtor in possession proceeding with the new management and new board in control. There's reorganization. Selling of assets is often part of the Chapter 11 process. Indeed, in FTX, there's been a monetization of the token portfolio as well as part of the ventures portfolio, really from the outset of the case.
With the Chapter 7 being the court-appointed trustee, just curious why it didn't go that route. My initial assumption is there's not the expectation that the court would realize the highest value in terms of that liquidation. So there was some effort to say, whoever the debtor is in possession of this process is going to be able to extract more value for the overall pie of lenders or creditors in this particular case. Is there anything more to it beyond that?
Yeah, I just think there's a practical expectation of the limitations of a Chapter 7 trustee, both in terms of expertise and of resources. So while the first day filings painted a pretty grim picture of the lack of financial records, and what could be ultimately some pretty dismal recoveries, I think from the ad hoc perspective and many that are in the crypto community realize that there is a lot of value here and there needs to be experienced professionals to make sure that that value is not squandered and that it's realized the maximum recoveries to creditors. If you turn it over to a court-appointed Chapter 7 trustee, those efforts would not have been undertaken.
Understood. Typically, what I was used to in distress situations was you had creditors involved with a lot of experience going through this process. There were often several classes of loans or bonds, and you had committees or groups formed where certain groups in the top tier of security joined together versus those lenders that were maybe a notch below, and everyone was fighting in terms of their efforts to get the maximum recovery to their specific group. How did it come together here? I don't imagine that you had the same setup in terms of the traditional lenders or funds that were involved, not even the amount of time to get those funds involved, at least in the beginning of this process. So can you just talk about what this process looked like relative to others that you've gone through?
Sure. I think big picture, at the outset, it was pretty clear that the FTX.com silo with the foreign customers was really the piggy bank for the entire enterprise. And yet you had these distinct silos from the .com exchange, the U.S. exchange, and then Alameda and Ventures as separate silos. So there was a recognition that if you were to keep those silos separate, you have this group of customers whose funds were stolen, yet there's not a token portfolio or cash sitting on the .com debtor's balance sheet. That's in various other silos, particularly Alameda was invested into some of the ventures portfolio or other third parties. So there was a recognition right up front that there was going to need to be a substantive consolidation of the estates to make sure that the value elsewhere that came from customer funds was allocated in a fair and really maximum amount that could be given to customers. So that's the first point. And then the second point about the capital structure is it was unique here. There are purported secured lenders at the Alameda silo, but their loan arrangements were often secured by FTT or other tokens. And again, we have that overlay of some of the collateral that may have been posted was actually customer funds. So at the end of the day, what we're really talking about is you've got the customers, and you can throw in the U.S. side here because I think their claims are so small that they're really not at odds with the foreign customers. But you have these customer claims, and many of the customers believe that they have ownership of these assets, that they should be superior to everyone as owners instead of mere creditors. But the question becomes, well, do we need to prove out the ownership arguments with tracing and identification of assets if we can just get the customers a maximum value of the estates? Because the general unsecured creditors here, besides the subordinated government claims, it's maybe around $2 billion at the end of the day. So many of those claims, there's counterclaims and settlements being worked out. So it's really not customers against general unsecured creditors as much as I think that's in the news. I think it's more making sure that the government agencies recognize that their claims are really for the benefit of customers and seeing any recoveries on those claims go to customers.
I'm going to just restate this so I think I understand it properly. There's one road that you can take where it's the customers proving that they have the most senior form, maybe not of actual lending, but they're actually owners of assets that were then taken from them. But if there's a way to just make sure that they're paid back in full, you don't actually have to prove that that was the case. Is that a fair way to represent it?
Yeah. It comes down to the property, the estate arguments that have been brought up in other crypto cases. In cases where it was a clear-cut ruling one way or the other, you actually had assets that were properly held in custody that were segregated. And here, there's no dispute that Almeida and other of the debtors and insiders misappropriated billions, probably north of $10 billion, in customer funds. The DOJ, other governmental agencies, and the debtors have been able to trace certain of those transfers into commingled customer accounts. So, okay, billions that were transferred out that were customer funds, and they can identify where they were invested into certain venture assets or went to buy a boat in the Bahamas, but not on account of individual customers. And there are also non-customer funds that were commingled there. So we could get into a very complicated exercise of tracing identification to say, on a pro rata basis, for the collective benefit of all customers, X went into the estates. We think that this appreciation in this particular venture's asset is due to customer funds. We could go through all that allocation. It would take months, if not years. We don't exactly know how it would end up. So what the ad hoc's position has been is, let's try to get the maximum amount to customers, pro rata for everyone's benefit of the estate value.
And if I just take that example and compare it to maybe a bank is the most simple comparison. If you were to see a bank go through a bankruptcy process, how would that differ just in terms of proof? And I think what you were keying in on there is specifically the custodial nature of funds. But how would it be treated if a bank were to go bankrupt? And I have a second example, but maybe we could just start there.
Banks can't go bankrupt because they have regulatory regimes that allow for their liquidation. And there's protection on customer deposits. And actually, depository relationship is one in which you actually do have a claim to the bank's assets. It's very different here, where there's an argument, I wasn't putting my assets on loan to the exchange. I own the assets. I was free to withdraw them. And I thought there'd be a one-to-one ratio of assets held by the exchange and what was recorded on my customer ledger. But in a bank liquidation situation, you would essentially take all the pooled assets and distribute those out to the depositors.
Okay.
It happens in pooled investments when you look at MF Global or other cases where there were pooled investments and similarly situated investors. They have allowed to have a distribution of the pooled assets pro rata to everyone according to the debtor's books and records. Again, the complication here is we don't have a nice little pot of customer funds. It's all mixed together with some non-customer funds and customer funds like.
That makes a lot of sense. And that's where I was going next, was something more in the exchange-like business category. And I think you answered it well there with MF Global. In this particular case, I think there were 130 related entities that along with FTX filed in this process. If you compare that to other cases, would you say that is a traditional amount of entities that you typically have with one of these? Is that uncommon? It feels like there's a lot going on there. But how different is that versus what you would see in your other cases that you're dealing with?
It's a substantial amount of debtors, but I think the general practice, particularly in Chapter 11, is you want to get the whole global business into Chapter 11. It's something that's unique about insolvency proceedings in the United States versus other jurisdictions, as there's very broad jurisdiction to file in Chapter 11. And if one debtor can satisfy the jurisdictional and venue requirements, you can bring in any other affiliate. That really helps to just streamline administration of the cases, to prevent infighting with the corporate entities. Again, particularly here where corporate distinctions were not respected, it made a lot of sense to file all the entities together and really prevent all the assets from being dissipated across the world.
In this process, how many groups ended up forming? You mentioned representing the ad hoc committee. Were there a lot of groups that ended up coming together? What did that look like?
No, not really. I think that speaks to the nature of the common customer experience, that they had terms of service that said you own these assets, and whether it was fiat or digital assets, when the bankruptcy filing hit, everyone lost their right to withdraw those funds. We have not seen formal groups come up on a splintering of the customer class. That could certainly occur, but I think the best result would be to have the customer class united and just trying to get the highest recovery for what is currently one customer class under the debtor's plan.
And did that form fairly quickly, just in terms of gathering? Again, I feel like usually you have these lenders who have sizable chunks of the debt, so they represent a large percentage. In this case, I would imagine it was very fragmented in nature, so just corralling all of that together would be a challenge. But what did that look like in terms of getting a united committee together?
Ad hoc officially formed on December 5th, and we had 3 members in the first week. And it was very difficult to collectively organize because the customer lists were also confidential in this case. So it wasn't like your typical case where you could look at the schedules and you could identify large holders. And everyone was very concerned about privacy and having to be disclosed as a member of an ad hoc committee. But it was really grassroots and contacts that I had around the world that my colleagues had, reaching out and wanting a voice in the proceedings and not really knowing where else to turn because they weren't getting a lot of information from the estates and didn't feel like the official committee that has fiduciary duties to all unsecured creditors in the case really represented them, particularly on these ownership arguments. So it continued to build and build and build. And as the underlying customer class has changed and had more secondary hedge funds in the customer class, the same is true with the ad hoc committee. In number, it's about 80% original holders, but in claim amount, it's more the secondary hedge funds at this point.
On the confidential point, did that have to do with this being a crypto asset, or is that just the nature of this type of business where you're dealing with something like an exchange?
There were 2 lines of arguments to keep the customer information confidential. The first was the damage that it could do to individuals by revealing their identities, particularly those in certain jurisdictions that would be identified as being wealthy. We've seen some personal stories there. The second line of argument was that the customer list is a asset of the estates or a reboot of the exchange or any other type of failed transaction involving the customer list. You would lose that value by revealing the customer identities.
With many Chapter 11s, you keep the business running, in this case, it would have been the exchange running. Didn't seem to happen here. Was there any portion of the business that was kept in operation?
The exchange was shut down, so it has not been operating throughout the bankruptcy proceedings. The debtors recently announced that they are not in the process of continuing with the 2.0 or exchange asset sale process. That said, they haven't taken it off the table. There was a robust marketing process, and I think there's still value in the customer list through a separate exchange. I think where there's just a misunderstanding in the customer base is the value that was attributed to the actual exchange, where I can say this publicly, I've gotten the go-ahead to say it, is that no bidder in the marketing process ascribed material value to IP or infrastructure or underlying technology. So I just think, as upset as some customers are that there hasn't been a concentration on a reboot, you can't control the market.
It's interesting because I think the headlines have suggested that the exchange business was a profitable business and much of the misdoing had to do with misallocation of funds into other endeavors, some of which you referenced before. That would lead me to believe that that was not the case, or maybe it wasn't as strong of a business as maybe some were led to believe. Do you think that's misrepresenting the situation in how I framed that?
Look, there was value in some of the trading products, for sure. But there is also heightened scrutiny from a regulatory standpoint on some of those trading products. So to say that the exchange had no value, I don't think that's the case. But in terms of a restarted exchange using the existing infrastructure and security and all the like, there was just not that ability to do so.
Yeah, I guess it's impossible to compare it to what was the exchange before this, because obviously what happened here had major implications for the entire industry and much of what happened in the year leading up to this. So impossible to ever go back and make a like for like comparison there. Getting back into the process itself, how things came together, you referenced some of the secondary hedge funds coming into these claims, just into this market. Can you talk a little bit about that, how that was in terms of evolving and developing? These claims get traded on the market again in traditional bankruptcies. I would imagine it looked a little bit different here. Did that have a major impact on the overall proceedings? And was there anything unique about the process evolving with maybe some more mature players and those that operate in this world?
I don't think that the participation of the secondary hedge funds is unique in this case where they think that they can drive returns. They will get involved. I think in terms of the actual claim acquisitions, there are some unique features in FTX. For example, not dollarizing claims at the outset, but scheduling all the liabilities in terms of the token and then having the estimation motion that would actually set the value for those tokens not heard until the end of January. That was unique in terms of pricing, but I think the market built in the right assumptions there. There's a KYC process that original holders have to undertake in order to receive distributions in the case. The portal that was set up and all the processes around that were geared towards original holders and not a secondary buyer. So that's added some logistical complications. I think there is a misunderstanding from the original customer perspective that is not familiar with Chapter 11 proceedings or the typical players therein, that there's something nefarious about secondary buying claims from original holders and that there's a big distinction between their claims. There's not, really. At the outset of the cases, when preferences were being focused on, you could argue there was distinction because secondaries were able to diligence possible preference exposure. But as we can get into with announced recoveries, it's likely that preferences will not be pursued. And so there's really not a distinction between the original and the secondary claim holdings at this point. And that's reflected in the treatment under the plan as well.
With the claims, just from the logistics side of things, I'm curious, with some larger bankruptcies, you typically have corporate customers that might have claims, and you'll have some traditional hedge funds that will purchase those claims. Here, a very different customer base. In terms of those claims actually exchanging hands, they're not just listed on the New York Stock Exchange in terms of buying and selling. What does that process look like if I wanted to go out and purchase some FTX claims? Do you have a sense of what that actually entails in terms of getting my hands on those?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's a number of different ways that buyers and sellers and some intermediaries have connected. The larger claims, it tends to be your more traditional outreach through a broker to the larger distress funds, and some of those have minimums that they're buying. There's also been a number of exchanges set up so that parties can connect to buyers very quickly. And because there is this unique customer code identification in the FTX schedules, and now that the dollarized amounts are known associated with the schedule tokens, it's been a lot easier from a pricing and diligence perspective. So I do think that there's still a bit of a shutout of your smaller claims in the market on both sides from diligence and cost perspective. but you are seeing smaller claims being traded through some of these online platforms that make it very easy to diligence the claims.
You've been mentioning dollarization a few times here. It's worth jumping into. I'll take my impression of what the issue is, and we can answer that. And then you can tell me whether I just had the wrong impression to start with. But if I am purchasing Bitcoin or Ethereum on FTX, I am typically sending in dollars to make that purchase. And there comes a question of, should my claim be calculated in terms of the dollar amount that I use to purchase that Bitcoin or Ethereum, or the actual Bitcoin or Ethereum that I purchased and how much it was and where it's trended over time. So is that a fair representation of what's going on with dollarization of claims and the challenges in terms of determining that? Because obviously the price has swung quite dramatically in terms of where Bitcoin and to a lesser extent Ethereum have gone over that time frame.
Because I think that there's some principles, because I think what you're seeing both in FTX and hearing through Genesis confirmation trial that began today is there's the bankruptcy code requirements that you can't get around. And then there are all parties' acknowledgement of equities. And how do we get the equities within the confines of the bankruptcy code? 502B bankruptcy code, it requires that claims be valued as of petition date in US dollars. That's done purposefully for equality of creditors so that you don't have different denominations or different time periods in which to value claims. So you really can't get around the dollarization of claims. In terms of in-kind distributions, if you have an unsecured claim, you get paid back in dollars unless you agree to some sort of equity interest. With the ownership arguments here, there is an equitable basis to try to make in-kind distributions, if you could. In Genesis, very different from FTX, said we're going to hold on to our crypto assets to try to do a in-kind distribution. The case, as of the petition date of the bankruptcy filing, there was such a shortfall in the token portfolio at the exchange that I think it was decided that's not going to be the best route, and it's going to be extremely costly. We're going to go for a value maximizing, prudent monetization of the illiquid assets for the benefit of customers. And so that's where we are. And certainly, I don't think anybody wants the estates to go out and buy crypto at today's market prices to make in-kind distributions. So I think what we're really talking about is the appreciation of the assets that the debtors are holding. Who should get that? Should it be that customers just get 100% of their petition date dollarized claim paid? Or should they have the benefit of appreciation that they would have otherwise had, but for the bankruptcy filing, given the ownership arguments? And then there's further arguments of, is there a distinction between someone that held BTC as of the petition date versus someone that held fiat? Because again, these weren't contracts denominated in one asset type. You were freely trading in and out. So I may have liquidated my token portfolio a couple hours before the bankruptcy filing because I wanted to get my funds out. Should I not get the value of the cost of capital and time value of money if I would have put that fiat right back into the market and seen the same returns as a crypto denominated claim? So what we're really talking about is you can't get around the dollarization of claims and value as a pitch date. We just need to figure out what's the best way within the confines of the bankruptcy code to make sure that that appreciation ends up in the hands of customers.
In terms of the assets that actually stayed within the business, have they been held there where there's some large balance of Bitcoin that has thus appreciated over this period of time? How does that get managed through this process, just in terms of when you have something like that, which isn't dollar denominated and is going to have a lot of volatility?
Yeah, well, the debtors have not been sitting on their crypto assets. There's been a monetization of those assets done through an independent manager, Galaxy. There are guardrails with respect to volumes and pricing to inform the sales, but it's been an ongoing process to monetize the token portfolio and the Grayscale interest, which were monetized for near $1 billion last month. So there's been an ongoing effort to convert the crypto assets into cash.
Is that voted on during the reorg process? How does that come to be where those guardrails are put in place? Who's the decision maker in terms of that?
Ultimately, the court. So the debtors proposed a motion with consultation parties, the official committee, our group, the ad hoc committee, weighing in with the debtors' professionals as to what those appropriate guardrails are. Everyone has an opportunity to object. Some parties did object, and then the court approved the motion over those objections.
Okay. I'm curious, when did that actually get approved timeline-wise?
Let's say it was in October.
Fall. Okay. Interesting. And I think we're getting into this a little bit, but as much as the headlines revolved around fraud within this business, there were some very valuable assets sitting within the business. So can you talk a bit about what the process was like to uncover this? Because again, it was not a traditional balance sheet in the way that I think things were managed or reported, but just the process of uncovering all of the assets and all of the value that sits underneath this umbrella and the timeline for that, and whether there's still key decisions to be made in terms of liquidating, monetizing, managing those assets from here.
Yeah. So really from the outset of the cases, the debtors professionals were working on putting together accurate and complete records, primarily the customer accounts, but also identifying what assets could be tied to those customer accounts. And as I mentioned, not all of the debtors' efforts have been put on the bankruptcy docket. But if you look at the criminal proceeding and the government exhibits that were put forth against SBF and the other co-conspirators, again, nobody is denying that billions of dollars of customer funds were misappropriated. And there has been an ability to trace where commingled customer funds, whether it was through bank records, whether it was through Slack messages that got discovered or emails that just got discovered, there's been a number of, there was a $500 million investment into this asset. There was a $100 million investment into this asset. That's about as far in the public domain, at least, than anyone's been able to go. And the issue is, again, when you're looking at those investments, this came up in the recent hearing on the Anthropic stake sale, where there was an objecting group that said there was $500 million of customer funds that were invested into Anthropic, and they're relying on this government exhibit. Well, it was $469 million of customer funds, and there was over $100 million of other funds, and then there were funds along the way that went to the ultimate investment. I ask this not facetiously, should we really require a source of funds for every sale? Some people have proposed that. Should we have the debtors go back and do a forensic accounting exercise and just halt the cases and don't sell anything until that's done? We could, but I think we're probably good enough to say, wow, a whole lot of this enterprise is attributed to customer funds. What's the way that we can get out of bankruptcy as soon as possible, get as much to customers as we can, confirm a plan under the bankruptcy code requirements, and save value? Because there's a number of different competing interests among the customer class, among creditors as a whole, where you could take a position that you're going to litigate these issues for maybe a marginally bigger slice of a undoubtedly greatly diminished pie years down the road. That's what we hope to prevent.
In the event that you have these instances of investments made that were not necessarily found via records, what ends up happening to those? The event that that comes out later, that there was a large investment into something that became very valuable, where does that ultimately fall in the future?
Yeah, so under the current plan construct, the way that it's designed is that where the debtors were able to find assets that were traceable to the dot-com exchange or to the U.S. exchange, that only those respective customers recover from those assets. And everything else is dumped into the general pool, which would be shared by really the waterfall, but it would be the customers get a priority payment. So they get a 66% priority payment from that general pool before it goes next to general unsecured creditors. It's almost like a lien for 66% of the customer claim amount. And so that's an acknowledgement of the difficulties of sorting out where all the value is, but also giving credence to the arguments on ownership that the customers have raised.
And maybe we can talk a little bit about the plan and the proposed recoveries, what that looks like. Can you outline? I don't know exactly where it stands today in terms of what's been approved versus not, but where we stand today in terms of that proposal and where that piece naturally fits into something within that proposal.
So at the January 31st hearing, which was on the debtor's estimation motion, debtor's counsel did make an announcement that they have a goal to have a plan filed by the end of this month, which I can tell you is not going to happen because
it's got a couple days.
Yes, but I think it will be filed in March that will pay not only customers, but general unsecured creditors in full, which means the par value of their dollarized petition claim. The wrinkle there is that would require the subordination, voluntarily or otherwise, of the CFTC, the IRS, and other governmental agencies that have over $20 billion in asserted claims at this point, because they are general unsecured creditors. And there's arguments to subordinate them without their consent, but the CFTC has already agreed to subordination of at least the par amount for creditors. And we would hope that the IRS and the other governmental agencies would follow suit.
Does that typically happen in these cases where the government is actually subordinate?
Actually, it does. Because when you're thinking about what are these government agencies asserting claims for, it's on behalf of the customers that were victimized. May have different definitions of victims according to their statutory dictates. But I think everyone can agree that the customers were victims here. With respect to the IRS, there is a directive from the tax division. It's tax directive number 137. And it asserts that in cases where there's a Ponzi scheme or embezzlement or misappropriation of funds that could give rise to constructive trust arguments, that the IRS should divert their recovery to those victims. So there's definitely, on an equitable basis, it makes sense. I think here there hasn't been all those arguments proven out to finality, but certainly we would hope that the IRS would recognize that there was customers' funds who were stolen, and they certainly didn't get the benefit of any revenue generations from the exchange.
In the IRS itself, their claims specifically, I would assume, are tied to tax payments, though. There's nothing else that they're representing beyond their traditional line of business, is there?
Yeah, I mean, the IRS has a real purse, so they're actually looking for a real recovery on the tax claims. Yeah. I think it's complicated here when you take a look at where those tax liabilities would actually sit. It's not with the foreign.com debtors. It's really with Almeida and the U.S. side and at the holding company level, which is what we call in bankruptcy structurally subordinate to claims at the operating level. So there's a lot of nuances to the IRS's claims. But again, if there could be a consensual agreement on their claims, that'll be the best route for everyone.
In terms of the other creditors' claims, I assume par is what they are looking for, aiming to get back. Is that a win if that's the outcome?
Well, everybody wants more money. So no, I think you could argue that it's a win, but I think for most of the customers, they're looking at this, that they've had their capital held up for a year and a half. They've seen appreciation in the marketplace where they could have been making those returns and haven't. And so getting their petition date claim paid in full does not feel like a win to them. We don't know what appreciation there is going to be 2 years from now when distributions are made in the case. But I think there's a very clear and united cry for whatever value there is, customers should get it, really shouldn't go to equity holders. And there's compromises that will need to be made to make that work to fit into the bankruptcy code, of course.
I would imagine that legally they only would have the right to the par amount unless they were to make the argument against the dollarization of that amount was. Maybe I misunderstand the code where they can actually get paid a recovery above par. Is that the case, or is there anything else they can do to actually come out with more than that dollarized amount?
There's post-petition interest, which is an equitable grant to unsecured creditors. It's typically implied where you have a contractual rate of interest and you have a solvent debtor. And the point there is you get the benefit of your bargain before equity holders do in a solvent debtor case. That said, this is all part of what we call a 90-19 global settlement of issues. So there's no reason why, as part of the overall settlement for customer ownership rights, you couldn't say that we will give post-petition interest and the highest amount permitted under law to customers in this case. And as long as the government agencies are okay with that and their recovery is being subordinated to it, then that should be fine. That's one avenue to get appreciation into the hands of customers. We're also looking at creative structures with gifting and redistribution, maybe through some of the government agencies. So lots to think about. I think we all want to get to the same end place and we got to follow the law, but it's a lot of compromise and getting a lot of people to agree to feel a little bit of pain, maybe, to get to the best result for everyone at the end.
Yep, understood. And if there were an agreement that was made and the various creditors were paid out, the remaining equity holders that hold on to what I would assume are mostly investment stakes in other entities, they just have control over those investments and monetize them as time goes on. Is there anything else beyond that?
So there have been discussions about having the ventures portfolio specifically, which would also tie into the unsold tokens. As part of the post-effective date, there'd be a trust that's set up, and then trust interest would go out to customers or other parties. I think there are some issues there from regulatory standpoint and otherwise, where if we can get upside interest to customers just through the estates, which would be a plan administrator would essentially be appointed and would continue to monetize assets after the bankruptcy case is closed, but then that would go into the recovery pool without a direct equity interest, but you're still getting the upside from the recovery pool of the estates.
And I'm curious, would that recovery pool be something that could be traded on a secondary exchange as well, where you have a claim and then you have access to that pool and I could potentially, or an institution could purchase those claims in the recovery pool?
In cases where there's a trust interest, that can happen. Here, if it's currently contemplated under the plan, it's just one claim and your recovery on that claim. So I think as there's disclosures made about what potential upside there is, you're going to see that impact the claims market. But there's not a separate instrument being contemplated as of now that would separately trade.
And I know it's not your direct line of work, but do you have any sense of where those claims are trading right now relative to par?
I do, because I haven't checked it in the last few days. But as of last week, I believe it was high 70s, low 80s, depending on the claim amount. Much higher prices than at the outset of the case, for sure.
Yes, I can imagine. I think we've covered all of the questions that I have. The last one is going to be just about milestones. But is there anything that you don't think that we hit on throughout the conversation that's an important piece to this story?
I think it's just important to remember that this case is different than other crypto cases where there's often comparisons. A lot can get lost with respect to those distinctions. And here again, we don't have customer groups that had separate contractual arrangements denominated by different asset types. It was all just your FTX account and you could trade in and out. And we had a lot of folks that were converting to fiat before the bankruptcy filing just to get their funds out. So I think the distinction between the crypto and fiat claims that's been asserted in other cases is really not as relevant here. That's the one thing that I would say to be careful of.
Mm-hmm. That makes a lot of sense. To close it out, I guess monitoring from here sounds like a plan that was expected by the end of the month might not happen by the end of the month. And we are recording this on Monday, February 26th. But what are the other key dates coming up or just general timeframes which make sense to be monitoring the situation?
Sure. So once the plan and the disclosure statement are filed, about 30 days from that time, you have your actual disclosure statement hearing in which the court will determine if there's adequate information in the disclosure statement for individuals to vote on the plan. Then you have your solicitation period, which can run as short as 30 days. It can go up to 60 days. I think we're going to try to keep the solicitation period as short as possible to give all the creditors time to vote on the plan. After the voting is received and tabulated, you go to your confirmation hearing, and that's really when the court decides all of these sticky legal issues that we've been talking about. And then after confirmation, you go to your effective date and you're out of bankruptcy. So as I mentioned, the debtors announcing that they were planning to file the plan and disclosure statement this month, and there's only a couple days left, that's likely to be pushed back. But if we can shorten the solicitation period and get the plan still filed in March, we should be still looking to exit bankruptcy before fall this year.
Excellent. Well, Aaron, this has been a phenomenal conversation. I certainly learned a lot, having some familiarity, but learned quite quickly. Not that much. Needed to brush up on a lot of this. Thank you so much for sharing all this and joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
To find more episodes of Breakdowns ranging from Costco to Visa to Moderna, or to sign up for our weekly summary, check out joincolossus.com. That's JOINCOLOSSUS.com.
A quick note before you go. If you are a company hiring or a candidate looking for your next opportunity, make sure to check out joincolossus.com/recruiting. We launched our recruiting efforts at the end of last year. We started working with firms that were interested in tapping into our audience. And after seeing some early success, we want to open this up to additional firms and to candidates who are proactively looking for their next opportunity. So we are mostly revolving around the investment world and the tech industry. But again, make sure to check out joincolossus.com/recruiting for more information.